stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you?
You.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN on this beautiful Thursday afternoon. Hope it's beautiful where you are as well. We do have a beautiful show ahead, and that's because you are part of this show. If you are a non-Catholic and you've got a question or two about the Catholic faith, we're here to get that question answered for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 3986. Are you listening to us outside of North America? We have listeners all over the globe. Here's our phone number for those of you outside North America. Dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email. The address for that is ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kavinsky, our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. He's keeping an eye on all things social, and that includes YouTube. So if you're watching us on YouTube right now, you would want to put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. Rich will see it. He'll do a little quick copy-paste, and then we'll get it, and then we're off to the races. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Doing very well. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you very much.
We have an interesting question to lead off. This is actually two questions from Tom in St. Louis. Dear Dr. Anders, thanks for your show. I really appreciate it. I'm a longtime listener. I think my vocabulary has expanded by a couple of hundred words since listening.
All right.
Pretty nice. Okay, first question. Recently, I observed a man going to communion while chewing gum. Should the priest have made him take the gum out before giving him the Eucharist? My concern would be Eucharist particles becoming embedded in the gum. Question two. Pre-COVID, the sign of peace at Mass was shaking hands with people nearby. With COVID, it became a hand wave. Since then, at my church, it has morphed into a two-minute event where many Mass attendees feel the need to wave to every person in the building. What is the sign of peace supposed to be per the Catechism of the Catholic Church? Thanks, Tom from St. Louis.
Yeah, thank you. So on the gum before communion business, so the law states that you're not supposed to eat before you go to communion. It doesn't specify what constitutes eating. Now, I will just tell you that if this were my household and a member of my family wanted to go up to communion chewing gum, they would not be permitted to do so. But I also I recognize that this is going to be an interpretation of the law and the spirit of the law that I'd be making as a father. And that's not my place with respect to the sacred liturgy. That job belongs to the priest, to the local pastor, to the ordinary minister of Holy Communion. And, I mean, I can't imagine a pastor saying, everybody pull out a, you know, big stick of Wrigley's and pass it around before communion. I mean, that'd be entirely inappropriate,
yeah.
You know. But it also wouldn't surprise me that, you know, to call someone out publicly for inappropriately receiving communion is a really big deal, a really big deal. And so what you don't know, first of all, you know, did the pastor know? And secondly, maybe you don't know this, maybe he pulled the guy aside, you know, or gave him a call next Wednesday or something and said, hey, Bob, you know, let's not come up to communion smacking away on a, you know, spearmint chewing gum or whatever it might be, you know. You don't know that he didn't have that conversation. But I do think, like, again, to publicly call someone out in a noticeable way when they're on the way into communion would make everybody think, like, my gosh, what did he do, you know? So you'd have to proceed with prudence in that.
Okay.
It's pastoral discernment.
Okay, very good. And then the other question?
Oh, yeah, the other one. What does the catechism say? So, well, the rubrics of the Mass don't indicate that the laity are to stop, wait, you know, drop, stop, and look, wave, you know, shake, rattle and roll, whatever it might be. Like this is not part of the rubrics of the Mass. This is a this is a kind of a unofficial tradition that's grown up in many places that could be edifying or not, depending on the context. And your concern, I think, is that, you know, that this thing, because it's not indicated in the rubrics, there really are no rules to regulate it, and it could grow beyond all bounds into something that has its own sort of meaning and significance apart from the meaning of the sacred liturgy, and you think maybe a distraction from the holy sacrifice of the Mass when we hear it, the most noble part of the Mass. It's not like it's disconnected from Christian fellowship. It's intimately connected to Christian fellowship. But you know, is this the time to express that fellowship, and in what form? So I think we can legitimately raise prudent questions about that.
Very good. Tom in St. Louis, thanks for your email. Here's one from Uganda, from Afima, who says, I can't understand the idea of reception of the Holy Eucharist by young, unwedded couples. Why can't young couples receive the Eucharist during Mass before a wedding, and yet they go to confession? I feel it is underprivileged many Christians who want to belong but couldn't afford a wedding, looking at how expensive it is today to organize one. I mean, they go to confession but don't receive Holy Communion. It seems unfair and unclear.
Okay, so you may be describing a situation that is very prevalent in Uganda, and I want to make sure that I understand the context, because I'm not connecting, right?
So yeah.
I think what you're suggesting is that you have a lot of young couples. And by young couples, I take it that you mean couples that are cohabitating with one another.
I think so, yeah.
Who are participating in the sacrament of Holy Confession, but not Holy Communion, because they have not yet been validly married in the church, right?
Yeah.
And I will say that that's an odd situation. Over here in the United States, we definitely have unmarried couples. Sometimes they present themselves for communion. Rarely do they regularly attend confession. So that would be extremely unusual in North America to find that. If they're going to treat the communion so in such a cavalier manner, they generally are okay with their consciences, thank you very much, and don't need to have them absolved, right? That's kind of the attitude. So that's unusual. Now, you stated as the reason they weren't marrying, there was an economic situation that constrained that. And again, that may be something that particular situation is a little bit more characteristic, I think, of Uganda. Let me come back after the break and touch on this a bit more.
Very good. We'll continue that. We'll also talk with Peter in Los Angeles. And there's a line with your name on it at 833-288-EWTN for a call to communion. Stay with us. It's called a communion with Dr. David Anders on this Thursday afternoon. This week is slipping by. Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Before we continue the program, we're going to come back to this interesting email that we got from Uganda. And the gentleman's name was Afima, or his or her name is Afima. Let me just repeat the whole thing, because there's quite a bit to it. I couldn't understand the idea of reception of the Holy Eucharist by young, unwedded couples. Why can't young couples receive the Eucharist during Mass before a wedding, and yet they go to confession? I feel it is underprivileged many Christians who want to belong but couldn't afford a wedding, looking at how expensive it is today to organize one. I mean, they go to confession but don't receive Holy Communion. It really seems unfair and unclear. Now, that is verbatim.
Yeah, thanks. So what I think is going on here is you've got young Ugandan couples who might otherwise be pious, and desirous of being validly married in the church, who have refrained from doing so because they can't afford the price of a wedding. And so they otherwise practice the Catholic faith, including going to confession, but they refrain from going to Holy Communion. And I pointed out before the break that this kind of situation is not typical in the West, right? Pretty much if somebody doesn't have the money for a big wedding, they'll have a little one. If they want to be married, they're going to get married. And if someone is staying away from Holy Communion, they're generally staying away from confession as well. And if they're going to communion with impunity, then they typically feel no need of confession. So you just wouldn't have this situation as it is in the in as you've described it in Uganda over here. It's a little bit unfamiliar to me. But here's what I'd have to say about that. First of all, I can understand that there is a cultural expectation that if you're going to get married, by golly, you better do it right and have a real mother of a blowout and invite everybody and his brother's son, you know, to a massive cultural feast and spend a lot of money and have a lot of fanfare. And I mean, I appreciate that. I appreciate that that could be a tremendous psychological burden. And I don't want to diminish that aspect, but there is nothing of the essence of the sacrament there. I mean, if what you're interested in is a valid wedding, a sacramentally valid wedding, the only thing necessary are vows and the presence of a priest. That is it. And that can be done on the cheap. So here is something that, I don't know, maybe it's occurred, maybe it hasn't occurred, maybe this is like culturally foreign idea and so maybe a little hard to assimilate, and it would be a real, maybe you get a lot of opposition from the in-laws and from grandmom. But it is a thought. There is nothing stopping a young couple in that situation to going to the priest and professing their vows in a basically free ceremony with very few witnesses, and then saving up and throwing the party 5 years later or 2 years later or whatever.
Sure.
Or even going through with a kind of renewal of their vows, where they had a kind of simulacrum of the wedding ceremony, where they have a priest there to bless them, and she wears whatever she wears, and he wears whatever he wears, and they have, I don't know what the traditions are in Uganda, but you could have the full fanfare of the cultural ceremony, basically to throw the party for the couple that was already sacramentally married in a way that they could afford. You could do that. You could pull that off.
Yeah, there you go. Hope that's helpful for you. Thank you so much for your email from Uganda. I remember, and I've probably mentioned this once or twice, going to a 6:20 mass in the morning at a local church here, St. Peter's. And, you know, it seemed like any other, you know, Thursday mass. And all of a sudden, there's a wedding happening. And,
yes.
And the witnesses yes. were just whoever happened to be there in the chapel.
Yep, I hear that. I hear you. But I am sensitive to the fact that, I mean, I have very limited knowledge, but some knowledge of what African weddings can be like. And the idea that you would just have a small affair with few witnesses is unthinkable in some context.
Sure.
Where you really have this expectation that you're going to invite the whole clan, and
yeah.
it's going to be a lot of people, and there are all kinds of expectations of what that looks like. And so I'm sensitive to, like,
oh, sure.
This is a big ask of somebody in that cultural context.
Yeah.
And it would take an awful lot of explaining. Right, of why we're going to do it this way, because we want to be obedient to the church, but we also want to be deferential to our families and to our traditions.
There you go. Hope that's helpful for you. Thank you so much for your email. We're going to get to the phones in just a second. Let me tell you about something wonderful now available from EWTN's religious catalog. They have recently added packs of 25 popular metals. Now, all these metals have O-rings attached. They're made of silver oxidized metals, and the metal choices include St. Benedict, the Miraculous Medal, Scapular Medals, Padre Pio, St. Christopher, Divine Mercy, and St. Faustina, St. Joseph. The list goes on and on. These are imported from Italy, and they are beautiful. Check it out by going to EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. Now, you may think, why would I want a pack of medals? Well, you may want to give them out to friends. Sometimes you can drop one in a public area. I know my wife picked up a medal when she was a little girl because she thought it was a dime, and she was fascinated by it. She still has that medal.
How about that?
There you go. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Peter, a first-time caller from Los Angeles, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today, sir?
Can you hear me good?
Yes, go right ahead, Peter.
Okay, my question is regarding suffering, human suffering. I just want to kind of get the Catholic perspective and doctrine on God's overall, you know, plan that, you know, sometimes, you know, we're trying to wrap our heads around the fact that there's a good comes out of suffering, on God's timeline. But, you know, Jesus, when the birth of Jesus, Herod went out and ordered the killing of the babies, But you know, as human beings, is this just our fallen nature, or is this now at the point where, is it just God up there just kind of watching, whether it's the Mideast or whatever, wars over the years, and just allows it to happen? And I don't see any good come out of it, whether it's your loved one suffering or your elderly mom or grandmother falls and has to go through all. But I'm just saying suffering in general. It's just God is just let it be, let him go at it, and I'll deal with it, you know, in my own way.
I'm with you.
It's just something we're just trying to wrap our heads
around. Okay.
Yeah, sure. I totally understand. So let me offer a perspective to you on the nature of Catholic doctrine. So before I deal with the specific doctrine about evil and suffering, I just want to deal with Catholic doctrine in general and what the Catholic Church teaches about its own doctrine is that our doctrine, our language about God, is imprecise and at best is an analogy, that we never say anything directly about God that is not an analogy. Because all of our concepts, all of our language is drawn from human experience, and God is not a human in the relevant sense, right? The incarnation notwithstanding. And so we're babbling a lot of times when we talk about God. Now, that doesn't make doctrine unimportant. It's incredibly important because it orients us existentially in the world. The Catechism says that doctrines are lights whose job is to illumine our path so that we know how to make our way in reality, and to help us attain goodness and beauty and truth. But that there's a kind of provisional and hazy, shadowy character to our language and our thoughts about God. St. Paul talks about us seeing as through a glass darkly and not face to face. And so here's why I'm saying that, right? There's a way of doing Catholic doctrine or Christian doctrine. I used to do it when I was a fundamentalist Protestant this way, where you really reason from the top down. You start at some abstract principle like, you know, God permits suffering and because he intends to bring a greater good. And that is true. I mean, that is the Catholic position. And then you try to deduce all the consequences from that and to draw out the relevant inferences to explain whatever you're going through. And what happens when you take that approach is, well, the proposition itself is perfectly clear. Okay, God allows suffering to bring a greater good, which is true. But when you start spelling it out in concrete instances, you're like, wait a minute, I'm not seeing any good here, right? And so the syllogism, the deductive reasoning kind of breaks down for you, and it leads to this kind of crisis of faith, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now, that's not an illegitimate way of doing business, and that is a legitimate way of doing theology, but it has limitations because, again, as you move from the premise to the conclusion, particularly in concrete instances, it begins to kind of break down. All right.
Okay.
There's another way of doing theology, and that's from the bottom up. That's from human experience upward. And so instead of starting with, hey, I've got this lock solid grasp on the nature of God and I can totally understand and explain God, I start instead with my own existential situation. Like, dude, I'm suffering. All right? I start with that fact rather than than some abstract proposition about God. I start with the absolute fact that I am suffering and the people around me are suffering. And I say, what can I do about it? Okay, well, basically nothing. All right. The universe consists in things I can control and things I can't. And the stuff I can't control is like everything. And the stuff I can control to a limited extent is my own thought life. That's basically what I have control over. Mm. And even that's not perfect.
Yeah.
I can kind of control my own thought life. That's how much wiggle room I have to affect my life, is to basically affect my own representations of reality. Okay. And from that end, what difference does it make to me if I go into suffering thinking, well, I'm suffering because God hates me and has a terrible plan for my life and wants to see me die in agony? That's not going to do a lot to advance me in wisdom, virtue, or charity.
Yeah.
But what if I go into it with this proposition? There's a loving God who has a plan. I don't know why this is happening, but it's happening to me for some reason that's intelligible, although not to me, and some good can come out of it, and doggone it, I'm going to find that good, or I'm going to strive for it with every inch of my being, and I'm not going to grow hopeless and despairing because I think that even though it escapes my rationality, there is some good to be realized here, even though I don't see it. Well, which one's going to get me out of bed in the morning? Right, the second one, right? And your question was really about the first way of doing theology. And I'm not ignoring that, but I'm saying don't discount the second way. Of that is to say that there really is a kind of existential payoff, you know, in the way you live your life.
Yeah.
If you can get up in the morning and have eschatological hope, if you can really believe that, yeah, there's a reason here, though I don't see what it is. So you have mystery at either end of the spectrum, right? But there's a way of approaching this topic where the mystery is productive and not destructive. You know, technically, from the way you ask the question, the Catholic position is God has a reason. We don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's some good, but we may not realize it in this life, right? I may not be able to pull it out or exegete it from every situation. But if you start at that point of mystery, you know, from the proposition, you may find yourself twirling off into despair. However, if you start with the despair and work your way up to the goodness of God, you might find you walk away from this with hope.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Michael, a first-time caller from Ann Arbor, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Michael, what's on your mind today? Michael in Ann Arbor, are you there?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I was busy.
Go right ahead.
Hi. So I moved into a college dorm and like a whole bunch of roommates and things. They're doing like parties with alcohol. And I am curious. I go to youth groups and stuff, but is it like okay to do this stuff with like friends and stuff and still put your faith first?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So let me tell you a brief story about myself, if I could, if you'd indulge me, because I am a convert to the Catholic faith. I did not grow up Catholic. And when I was in college, I went to, let's say, a well-known research university in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana. Okay? You don't have to be too creative to come up with what that's likely. And it was very close to Loyola.
Got it.
And let me tell you something. There was some partying going on in New Orleans, Louisiana. In fact, most of my college dorm mates were sloshed, you know, more often than I had a dorm mate who would literally spend days at a time recovering from his last bender, and then wake up at some odd hour and head off on another one. Right?
Wow. You know?
And I mean, it was pretty wild. But there was one guy on my dorm who didn't talk a lot about religion. But he wore a crucifix, and we all knew he was Catholic. And he'd gone to a Catholic high school that he thought a lot of, a Jesuit high school. We knew he loved his Jesuit high school. And one thing I noticed is that we would all kind of go out together, and you know, everybody else would be three sheets to the wind. And then here's this one fellow, the Catholic guy, and he might have a beer, but he didn't just go blotto, you know? He didn't just go nuts. In fact, he kind of sat back and sort of laughed at all the people that were going nuts. And he held himself a little bit aloof from it, but in a good-natured way, right? And he didn't chase women in an indecent way. You know, he didn't give himself to dissipation. He had fun, mm-hmm. and he had friends, and we liked him. But we also respected him, right? Because he didn't go all in. And he wasn't the only reason I became Catholic. But, you know, years later, when I started investigating Catholicism, I thought back on that guy. And I thought, you know, his Catholic faith made him a good-natured person who was fun to be around, and I enjoyed him, and he had a personality. But he also was a rational man who, like, controlled himself and his passions and set a good example of what life in society could be like, and that was because of his Catholicism, which he did not hide.
There you go, Michael. Some things to think about and perhaps pray about. Thanks so much for your call. In a moment, we'll talk with Father Jedediah in Dayton. The lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. So what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Well, let's talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. Still time for your call at 833 888-EWTN. Maybe you'd like to explain what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Well, 833-288-3986. Hey, our friends listening in Nebraska and central Wisconsin, wow, we need to get a message out to you. Spirit Catholic Radio, airing their fall pledge drive starting on Monday on their 19 stations throughout Nebraska and central Wisconsin. So if you're listening to us in Nebraska, central Wisconsin, or anywhere, remember to support your EWTN Catholic radio station. All right, back to the phones now. Here is Father Jedediah in Dayton, listening on Sacred Heart Radio, AM 910. Hey there, Father Jedediah. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, guys. Big fan of the show. And I was curious. I've heard Dr. Anders mention on multiple occasions that he really likes the NRSV Catholic. And I was curious. I really respect Dr. Anders' opinions on things. And what is it about that translation that really speaks to you, Doctor?
Thanks. I appreciate the question. So since you're a priest, you're a priest, right? I think you're a priest.
Yes.
Father Jedediah.
Yes.
That's
since
right.
You're a priest,
yeah.
And you yourself are a preacher, proclaimer of the gospel, I will give you a reference that I might not give to every layperson. You might know the name of Michael Gorman, who teaches, I think, at, what is it, St. Mary's Seminary and University. He's the Raymond Brown Professor of Biblical Literature there,
okay.
I believe, right? He has a book entitled Elements of Biblical Exegesis, which is about exegeting passages of Scripture, where he actually lists his preferences for Bible translations. And you'll note that, and particularly with an eye to exegesis, and he likes NRSV, among others, sort of at the top of his list. And you'll get a more detailed explanation of the reasoning. But basically, I like the NRSV because it's a formal equivalence translation that follows the most up-to-date scholarship in textual research. So it's based on the most scientifically compiled manuscripts with a philosophy of formal equivalence, meaning that it's translated with an eye to exegesis, not dynamic equivalence, which is, you know, sort of idiomatic, you know, ease of reading and language.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like dynamic equivalence because they're more interpretive, obviously. They're farther away from the wording and the syntax of the original text. And, you know, granted, it's possible to, you know, to know enough exegesis to be dangerous. I mean, I remember talking to a fellow one time who said his son took just enough karate to get beat up, you know, and you can do that with scholarship as well, right? But you know, and I'm not a biblical exegete by training, I'm a historian, but I understand some of the principles, and whenever I read the Bible, I mean, this is just me, I never stop at an English translation. Like, if I want to know what's going on in any text, I'm going to look at, you know, a good formal equivalence translation like the NRSV, but I'm also going to look at the Greek, I'm going to look at the Hebrew, and I've studied Greek, I never studied Hebrew, but I know enough about languages that I can, you know, grab a lexicon and concordance, and I can do some real damage. So I'm going to look at both of them, and then I'm going to read commentaries and this kind of thing. I really want to kind of get behind it, understand what's going on, and you know, there are occasions, I'm not even going to say the translation because it would be both misleading and humiliating, but like there is a translation that was very common when I was in evangelical seminary that a lot of my evangelical seminary professors worked on, right, that I think theologically is really no good at all. Like, I would never recommend it to anybody, but it's really readable. It's really readable, you know? I like the English that's used, and in my own private reading, like, I'll sometimes read that, but only because I know enough to know where it's wrong.
Okay.
You know, I know enough to know where it's wrong, and I know how to get behind the text and correct the errors. But I would never recommend it to someone who didn't have some formal training in Greek and exegesis, because they would be caught unawares.
Sure, sure. Father, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I love the RSV, NRSV for different reasons, and the manuscript basis for the NRSV, love that. So I'm just curious where you fell on that, and
yep.
I really appreciate your time.
Go check out Gorman's book.
We appreciate your call. Thanks, Father. Let's go now to Lamar in Winter Haven, Florida, listening on YouTube this afternoon. Hello, Lamar. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I like your question. I like your show. I like your question. I'm Catholic. And your question is always, why are you not Catholic? And so we don't have a lot of people call back and say, here's why I'm not Catholic. So in my life, I will go out and ask somebody, why are you not Catholic? And I just got an answer that I wanted to share with y'all and let Dr. Anders respond. And the answer was, I've never been asked to be a Catholic. I've never been invited to go to a Catholic church. And that was it.
Wow.
Sometime in 2003, I moved far enough along in my interest in Catholicism that it was time to start asking questions of priests. And so I reached out to the parish that was closest to my place of work, made an appointment to go visit a priest, and I'm a scholar and a historian, and particularly at that time of my life, I carried a notebook with me wherever I went to take notes on anything I was studying, and I sat down in his office and I pulled out my notebook, and he said, "You're not with the newspaper, are you?" I said, "No, I just like to take notes." And he said, "Okay, I've had reporters bite me before, you know." Said, "No, this is not some sort of sting operation, Father." And I started asking questions, and he revealed to me that, you know, he said, "Well, I've thought about leaving the church and know the Pope's not infallible, and he started saying all this kind of stuff that I knew wasn't consistent with the Catechism, and I went, "Oh, he's one of those kinds of priests, you know." And I thought, "Well, okay, that's not going anywhere." I mean, he's a nice guy, and we had a nice conversation, but I was like, "He's not going to give me the answers that I want because he doesn't necessarily believe them, right?" You know. So I move on to a second priest, and he was a nice fellow, but he didn't register 0.1 on the Richter scale of emotion, you know, and so it wasn't like he said anything wrong. He just didn't say much at all. You know, I wasn't getting a lot of traction out of him either. Okay. And then I finally knock on the door of a third priest, and boy, was he happy to meet me. And he rolled out the red carpet for me, and he was so interested in answering my questions and getting me into the Catholic Church. And in fact, if it weren't for this priest, I don't know if I'd be Catholic.
Really? Today,
because he, I started talking to him, and he basically said, "Okay, you know, it's time to put up or shut up, and I've got November the 16th free on my calendar, so I'm going to make you Catholic then, if that's all right with you, and canon law says I'm supposed to instruct you, so here's some tapes, go listen to them, come back on the 16th, and whammo, I'll make you Catholic, you know, you it's time." I mean, he really put it to me, and made me make a decision about whether I was going to become Catholic or not, and he pushed me over the edge, and I'm really grateful for that. But in the course of the conversation, when I first started it with him, I said, "I'm thinking about becoming Catholic," and he said, "Are you marrying a Catholic, or did you read your way in?" Well, in my case, it was option B.
I
read my way in. But it's always struck me after the fact, and he was really eager to have me, and he really helped me a lot, but it's always struck me after the fact that he didn't say option C. It wasn't, "Are you marrying a Catholic? Did you read your way in? Or did the Wednesday night evangelism group come knock on your door?" He didn't say that. And he didn't say it for the obvious reason that there is no Wednesday night evangelism group. Now, by contrast, I have visited Protestant churches where there absolutely was a Wednesday night evangelism group that showed up at my door, right? And this is a deficit. It's an objective deficit in Catholic culture and Catholic parish culture in particular. And there are all kinds of historical reasons for that. I do think it's something that the hierarchy is aware of. I don't think that Catholics, it's very hard to change cultures, right?
Yeah,
it's not easy to change a culture,
yeah.
Right? Even if you know that there are objective issues with it, right? But this is a feature of Catholic parish culture in North America, among other places. And, you know, one of the historic reasons is that American Catholics for the longest time were a persecuted minority who had to keep to themselves. I mean, we have even 100 years ago, not that long ago, in Birmingham, Alabama, there is a Catholic priest who stuck his head up above the waterline and made a public figure of himself and defended Catholics, and he literally was shot dead in broad daylight for his pains. Well, that doesn't have to happen to you too many times before you start keeping your head down, right?
Yeah.
And up until the Kennedy administration, I think a lot of Catholics in North America just wanted to be left alone so they could practice their religion. And that gets inculcated in you of, you know, don't make waves, don't say things, because you'll get shot down, literally. That's not the culture we live in anymore, but we need to get over that reticence about sharing our faith as Catholics.
Yeah, and there's a lot we can learn from our Protestant brothers.
Absolutely.
You better believe it. Lamar, thanks so much for your call. That's a great point that you have just made. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad that you're with us. Let's go to Patrick in Dallas. Is listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hi, Patrick. What's on your mind today, sir?
Oh, hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, so I'm not a Catholic. I've been listening to this show, and I've been drawn to learn more about the Catholic Church. One thing I'm getting hung up on is the praying to saints. And I've kind of looked into this more and heard some of the things you've been saying and talked to some other Catholics about it. But my understanding is when you're praying to a saint, I just thought you were praying to a saint like you'd pray to God. But then somebody explained to me, well, no, you're praying for that saint to intercede on your behalf and appeal to God for whatever you're asking for, or whatever help. And then I heard somebody else talking about, another Catholic talking about how some saint that helped you sell, I don't know, selling your house or something like that, and how that saint came down and helped them sell their house. Or there was another saint that helped them find a watch that was missing. And this is just kind of confusing me. Are you praying to the saint to ask for God to help you, or does that saint literally like coming down in spirit and helping you do whatever you're praying?
It's a great question. Great question. Yep. Fantastic question. So as I begin to answer this question, let me ask you, are you some kind of practicing Christian right now?
Yes, I am. All right. I'm actually a Presbyterian church.
Okay. Yes. I grew up Presbyterian. In your Presbyterian church, do church members routinely pray for one another?
Yes.
Okay. And you acknowledge that all of the people being prayed for could, in fact, just pray to God directly and not ask for the intercession of their friends and neighbors, correct?
Yes.
But nevertheless, you think there's some utility in their asking their neighbors to pray for them, or else they wouldn't do it, right?
Correct.
Okay, first of all, what do you think that utility is? Like, if the Presbyterian can pray directly to God and does pray directly to God, then why ask your Presbyterian friend to also pray for you? What value is there in doing that?
Well, I think that with members of the church, and then I think, I can't remember where exactly in the Bible references that God hears the prayers of the righteous. If you know somebody that, you know, in your church that you look up to, and you know that God would hear their prayers, and it's just another person praying to God.
Bingo.
Whatever you're
Bingo.
Doing. Yeah.
Bingo. You put your finger right on it. So there's a couple things with asking your friends to pray for you. One is, as you said, the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. That's James chapter 5. Many people often quote Matthew 18, when two or more are gathered in my name, I'm there also. So you know, if we get two people on the job, it's better than one person. And then there's another benefit that people rarely quote scripture for this, but I really do think it's a palpable reason why people ask their friends and neighbors to pray for them, and that is that you just like to know that somebody's in your corner. You know, it's a way of expressing, asking for and expressing charity and mutual concern. So all three of those are valid reasons to ask your friend or neighbor to pray for you. Express your concern, show your concern, you know, have greater confidence that more people are on the job, and maybe one of us in this group is holy, so maybe God's more likely to listen to them. All that comes into play, okay? So that is exactly the same when a Catholic asks a saint to pray for him. So to begin with, he thinks that, you know, two people's better than one. He thinks that holy and righteous people are probably better than rank pagans in terms of getting prayers answered, and the saints are with you on both of those. And it furthers charity within the body of Christ, because we think the body of Christ extends to heaven and purgatory. It doesn't just include people alive on earth today. It's anybody. You know, Jesus said, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And these people are alive to us, and we can have a relationship with them through prayer and intercession by an act of faith. So all that plays in. Now, in terms of the mechanics, you wanted to know about the mechanics. The power of intercessory prayer is going to God. Right, so it's the saint's power in your life is no different from your friend or neighbor's power to ask God for stuff. to ask God for good things on your behalf. That's the power of the saint. He doesn't have any kind of power independent of God. Now, is it possible that God could also, in extraordinary cases, cause a particular saint to be manifest to an individual on earth in some way to strengthen their faith? Well, Scripture says yes. And I can't think of a better example than the Mount of Transfiguration. Do you remember when Moses and Elijah, Matthew 17, Moses and Elijah show up with Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration? Why are they there? Well, maybe a lot of reasons, but not the least of it is to bear witness to the disciples, Peter, James, and John in particular, showing that all the law and the prophets testified unto Christ. So if you can, I mean, I don't know what happened in the great beyond, but I mean, to speak in a kind of casual manner, imagine Moses and Elijah are kicking back, you know, playing bridge, waiting for the Messiah. And suddenly the voice of the Almighty comes and says, boys, I got a job for you. You know, I'm going to send you down to the Mount of Transfiguration, and you're going to show up with my son Jesus and bear witness as the law, as the representatives of the law and the prophets, for the benefit of the disciples. So we know that it happened at least once in human history. It happened more than that, but it happened at least once.
Yeah.
That's not normal, but it can happen. It can happen. Now, the business about this saint helped me sell my house. Let me go into that a little bit. So not everything that is a Catholic tradition is a Catholic tradition with a capital T, okay? And in a broad sense, Catholics do a lot of stuff in the handing on of the faith, and some of it has a long history and is beloved, but is really less central to the tradition. And sometimes we have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, all right? This is one of those things. So it may happen that a saint, say the story of his martyrdom or his life, for example, is associated with you know, some episode, and that captures the Catholic imagination. Think about St. Francis and the animals, for example, okay? And you can't think of St. Francis and not think of him out there preaching to the birds. You know, he's gone to the birds. And so that captures the imagination, and it's memorable. And so people, as they have developed devotion to the saints over the years, they may come to have a particular association between a saint and that kind of episode. And it might develop into a tradition of, well, hey, you know, if you need your animal blessed, bring him on the feast day of St. Francis. And that is a Catholic tradition to do that.
It is.
As long as you take it in a kind of playful, lighthearted spirit, not too seriously, it's a kind of fun thing. You know, it's a little bit like Father Christmas or something, all right? If you take it too seriously, it can become a superstition where suddenly you think that the efficacy is, oh, well, you know, you didn't do it on the feast day. And, you know, you asked St. Jerome and not St. Anthony to help you find your lost keys. And so, I mean, that would be superstitious. Okay.
Right.
As long as you take it in that kind of spirit of playfulness, then that's kind of delightful and it's memorable. And it's just a way of sort of stimulating the Catholic imagination. I give you an example from my evangelical Presbyterian background. When I was 2, 3, 4, 5 years old in Presbyterian school, you know, they teach you these Bible songs. And one that's stuck in my head is Father Abraham. I don't know if you remember this one. I'm not going to sing it to be embarrassing. But, you know, Father Abraham had many sons had Father Abraham. I am one of them, and so are you. And let's all praise the Lord. Right arm. Now all the 5-year-olds start waving their right arms. And then you do it again, and it's left arm. And then right foot and left foot. Maybe you know the song. And then before long, you have this room of 4-year-olds all like gesticulating wildly and spinning in circles and then sitting down simultaneously. And it's just all good fun, right? It took me years of growing up to figure out why in heaven's name I was invoking Father Abraham while spinning in circles like some kind of crazy top. Like I had no idea as a kid why I was doing that, right? But why? It was, you have a room full of 4-year-olds you're trying to keep in line. You come up with a silly tradition that invokes the name of Abraham. That is not more intelligible than that, right? You know, so we all do this kind of thing.
Okay. There you go. Patrick, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, it's really helpful. I do appreciate it. I appreciate the show. And
fantastic.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you.
Keep listening to EWTN. You will learn a lot, and you will grow in your faith. called to communion here on EWTN tonight on the world over with Raymond Arroyo. Gerhard Cardinal Mueller, former head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, talks about Pope Francis's recent remarks on other religions. You may have heard about that. Also, the agenda of the upcoming Synod on Synodality, which is going to be in October. Also, the papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, react to the Mueller interview and discuss the other big stories of the week. And comedian Rob Schneider comes by. He'll be talking about his career, his Catholic faith, and his new book, You Can Do It. You can also get news from the world over in your email inbox every week. Visit EWTN.com, click on subscribe. Again, the world over tonight with Raymond Arroyo, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN radio and television. Let's go now to Margaret, a first-time caller in Oklahoma, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Hello, Margaret. What's on your mind today?
So in today's reading, first reading, is from the letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 15, verses 1 through 11. And there's a line in there that says, "Last of all, as one born abnormally, he appeared to me." What does it mean by born abnormally?
Yes, thank you. So St. Paul was almost boastful about the fact that he was an apostle. And he really wore that on his chin. And he let you know, if you were in one of his churches, that he had seen Christ our Lord. He had a commission from Jesus, and he was in fact an apostle. Right? So you weren't going to take that away from him, and he had authority because Christ had commissioned him. However, St. Paul was unlike the other apostles, and particularly unlike the 12, in two ways. One, he was not one of the 12. He never knew Christ when Christ was walking on planet Earth. He only knew the resurrected Jesus. It was the resurrected Christ who appeared to him. He did not know Christ when Christ was in his earthly ministry. So he wasn't part of the original company of the disciples. Secondly, Paul started his professional career in religion, as it were, by killing Christians, by persecuting them, and by opposing the very movement he later championed. And so he recognized that God's call to him was really a kind of condescension, an act of pure grace, nothing that Paul had merited, that God reached out to him, you know, though he, Paul, had utterly alienated himself from the Christian community, I mean, intentionally and violently, God said, "It's okay, I'm going to use you as my instrument." And so Paul's apostolic call, his call to the life of an apostle, was unusual. It was unusual in those two ways, and thus abnormal.
And there you go. Margaret, thanks so much for your call. Here is Katie now, a first-time caller from Omaha, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hey, Katie, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello, good afternoon. I was just wondering, today is the feast day of St. Januarius, and I was wondering, what is the significance of his blood becoming liquid on certain feast days?
Well, for devotees of St. Januarius, the event is understood to be miraculous, and miraculous events exist by God's providence to encourage the faithful. So that is the significance. You know, the veneration of saints and their relics is a very traditional part of Catholic life and Catholic prayer and Catholic faith and Catholic devotion. And should be encouraged by all means necessary. Occasionally, it would seem that in divine providence, God takes steps to encourage it directly. Yeah. And so miracles associated with the saints and their relics is one way of doing that.
Yes, indeed. Katie, thanks for your call from Omaha. Quick question from Scott watching us on YouTube. Is the study of biblical typology helpful for Catholic and non-Catholics in understanding Catholic doctrine?
Well, of course it is. Absolutely. However, I want to issue this caveat, this caution. Typically, Catholics will talk about allegory,
uh-huh,
and Protestants will talk about typology. And they will deliberately eschew allegory as a hermeneutical method. Now, there are a number of Catholic biblical scholars who are converts from Protestant tradition. I'm thinking in particular of Scott Hahn and John Bergsma in particular, right?
Sure, sure.
And with these kinds of fellows, it's not uncommon for them to use the language of typology, and it's becoming more common among biblical scholars at large to talk in terms of typology, although the traditional Catholic language and framing is allegory rather than typology. So yes, study typology, but be aware of the provenance of your book, all right, or the author, because sometimes the language is kind of taken over, particularly by Reformed Protestants, as like their territory. And I do want to caution you about Reformed or Calvinistic interpretations of Old Testament typology, which are definitely part of the literature, and you just need to know that that's out there. So make sure, if it's not a Catholic you're reading, be aware of that. You know, look for Catholic authors. If you're interested in typology, you might get... Scott Hahn published his doctoral dissertation in, you know, popular format.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
name has gone right out of my head. It's a big old fat book, but it's, you know, it really goes into the biblical typology from a Catholic point of view. So you might check out Scott Hahn's work on that.
Scott, thanks for checking us out on YouTube. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Be sure to join us tomorrow at the same time for another edition of Call to Communion. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price. We will see you then. God bless.